programa.
Hello and welcome to Dynamite Nebby. It's the retro games podcast where a couple of owl pals get together and talk about a couple of owl games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we have Mr. Mick McCormick.
Hello.
And Mr. Andy Mack.
Hello.
Oh, that was a wee bit accented there. I don't know.
I was choking when I said it at the same time. Sorry.
I don't know why it's always Japanese related stuff that that always has us teetering on a kind of periphery of being cancelled. But a good news is we've got three Japanese games a day, so sample opportunities for controversy.
That's what it's like. It's like you can appreciate the art, but you don't need to appreciate the artist.
Aye, like
Lost Prophets. No, kidding on. The fucking joke.
Michael Jackson, maybe.
Michael Jackson. Who's the other man? There's a few. If somebody say David Bibby, there's a few things getting said about him. Aye. And obviously the most recent revelation is Bob Dylan.
Well, I'm sure the regular listeners, the eagle-eared among you, will enjoy tuning in for our famous paedophiles segment. we've had some good input for Andy. McCormick, he's a famous pedo.
Ralph Harris.
Oh, yeah, classic.
He's one where you don't have to worry too much about like separating the art for the artist, because his art wasn't very good, was it?
Nah, them poor animals, man. I knew after that duck's face, man, what was going on.
I will hit out with, he's not an artist, but Prince Andrew. Let's keep that one in mind.
No further action, Prince, no further action.
That's with the Met Polis. Thank you for tuning into our regular segment on Prince Andrew updates. The Yanks are still trying to arrest him.
Aye, it's a civil case, isn't it? So the arcot will be the next skin off his ass, man. You know what will happen? It'll just be the old fucking water under the bridge stuff, won't it? For the royal family. Wankers.
As per.
Ach, what can you do? Fuck them anyway, I'm not going to do with us. We're Scottish. Let's go.
A few countries have the right idea. The old French and the Russians, I think, gave their royal families a proper send-off.
Aye, and that was the best way to do it. And the good thing was they were humane about it, because they made that blade so that it was to keep less, at least suffering possible, you know? Still get rid of the problem, but it never went out suffering.
That like, was the French. The Russians shot fuck at them.
Aye.
So what we're doing here is like viewership numbers have been good doing a wee bit, so we're trying to supplement that by adding in a few NSA listeners just to get the numbers up a wee bit, you know.
Well, lads, it's been a wee while. There's been a couple of fucking big moments in gaming. I'm sure me and McCormick will get on to talking about the second chapter of Deltarune in a wee bit, but yep. Andy, what have you been occupying yourself with in the last wee while? And do you know what, I might even fling a wee movie corner your way as well after you've told us about games, but go for it.
Aye, so we obviously covered Knights of the Old Republic before.
Aye.
And, at the time, I'd only played the start there. I kept getting the Chewbacca guy, Big Z. I know that's a pure generalisation, but I kept getting him stuck at one point and I couldn't get him back into the party and that. And long story, I never get by his bit, but I've been getting right back into it. And, I feel myself getting just tuned into this mad fucking Star Wars epic, but it feels like playing Star Wars, but it feels like you're in a Star Wars kind of environment, but it's still got like good part. It's like weird.
Well written, isn't it?
Aye, it's got funny dialogue in that, aye.
I like the wee fucking robots and that. They're just fucking, there's one robot, right, that's trying to run away from its owner, because the owner is projected to it must have lost her husband or something, and she's projected the love for her husband on this robot.
Well, Andy, that was the name of the episode when we covered Knights of the Old Republic was actually Shagging a C-3PO. Because the woman was Shagging a C-3PO. However, you dealt with this quest in quite a different way than we did. Why didn't you talk us through that?
So I was still trying, obviously this is your second level into the second planet, so you're still learning your bearings, trying to become a Jedi and that. And you're cutting about the fields, you end up meeting the other wee Jedi woman that kind of, she went down the dark side, and you end up saving her. And then you wander about and you just notice this wee fucker hanging about. It looks very conspicuous, but he's kind of just looking at his guy and that. You walk over to him goes, oh, that's cyborg relations, whatever they do. And then he goes, and then fucking, if you find out, right, that he's fucking on a run.
David Attenborough.
Find out he's on a run for his owner, because the owner wants to pump him, right? But man, I wasn't having it. I was like, look, man, she's paid good money for you, mate, right? So fucking
Jesus.
Back you come. And I sent him, made him fucking get back to his owner again. She did say thank you, and I says, no worries, pet. And that was it.
Did you get some dark side points for that one?
Yes, I did, yes.
I consider that pretty dark myself.
See, I just had a very dirty thought, which is like, you could just gear the old lightsaber and be like, don't use the, you know, the hot end. it's a non-sentient vibrator. People use them for centuries. You're not going to form any weird attachment to them.
Oh, fucking hell. That thought never crossed my mind. Since we left Dantooine, me and the troops, there's been a few funny things happening. We went to Manan, which apparently isn't the best place to go.
Neutral planet, Switzerland planet.
Aye, they're keeping the peace essentially, but I get chucked off the planet, man.
Did you poison their water or whatever?
Aye, well, I done what I was told, mate.
the Nuremberg defence.
And I didn't know there was an option to save the shark, so fuck it, man. And apparently I've nearly brought a galaxy in its knees because the equivalent of oil's gone.
Did you pick up HK? Are you kicking about with HK yet?
Well, that's what I done. I went to Tatooine second, and I couldn't afford them yet. So I said, I don't want to do this mission without a dude, man, because he's quite funny. So I went to Manan to try and build up the old Republican credits, which I've done now. So I'm going to go and get HK-47 and go and negotiate with the Sand People.
Aye. That's, Andy, I'm telling you right now, that is going to end with you fucking slaughtering the Sand People. You will murder fuck out of them.
Aye. I played a bit of Cassic, where you're doing in the Nether regions, and then you get that wee bogging guy in that, and what's his name? Wee bogging guy that lives in a hut and that, like Yoda, Shrek or something.
You get fucking Joe Lee, don't you? He was one of my favourites, a kind of owl hermit Jedi master. Like.
Aye, and I made a fortune, man, slaughtering fucking goblins. For the Galactic Empire, aye. Honestly, they're growing.
Are they called goblins?
I don't know. I kind of characterise them in my head as that, so when they feel so bad.
I'm sure there's a spacier word for them in the Star Wars universe.
He's right, but they are fucking goblins. Because it's Star Wars, they have to call them, like, gazorks or something like that. Do you know what I mean?
But they've got a brilliant brain. It's like monkey brains in it. Like, they're worth a lot of money. They've got some sort of pearl inside them.
Oh, it's tax. They're these wee monkey hangs, and then a gland. They use it to make wine.
I had a pocket full of them, man, and the bottom half is not. I kept them more. Made a good bit of money.
I'm going to also throw you over to Film Buff Corner for a wee minute here.
All right.
Because a big movie's come out. I think a lot of our listeners, we'll keep this spoiler free in case you haven't seen The Sopranos. But broadly, I kind of liked The Many Saints in Newark, but Andy didn't really like it. And I've not really asked him too much about why I thought I would do it on air.
Didn't have the makings of a varsity athlete. I thought like, the components were there, but it was definitely different. I mean, I'm probably just parroting here, man, but I had a look at what other people were saying, and it kind of congruent with what I thought. And
aye.
It's like, you know, the producer, David Chase, the writer on that, he's a bit like Vince Russo at WWF in 1999, but he's good at starting things off, but he doesn't really close anything very well.
This is a reference to the Sopranos' infamous ending as well, I guess.
Well, I think that was done quite well, but like, there's a lot of like, plots that are opened up in the film that just go nowhere.
I thought maybe one of its worst sins was that it lacked a wee bit of focus. Like,
aye.
Is this film about race riots, or is it about young Tony, or is it about this guy, or is it about that guy? But I think as a wee bit of fan service, it kind of worked. Like,
it did, but see if it was 4 hours long, I think the film had a bit longer. Like, see, right, man, obviously there was a lot of fan service in it, right? But the fan service kind of was a weakness for me because them characters for the TV show have got so many dimensions to them, but we only seen like the kind of most, the three most popular attributes of each character, knee deep on that.
It was a wee bit catchphrasey, and some of the characters were just like, the wee guy playing young Silvio was just doing a fucking impression of little Stevie, wasn't he? Just the face and all that. But
I got, they kind of made him too much a comic character, and he was always kind of funny, weren't he? But he wasn't that funny, he was actually a sociopathic fucking psychopath that kind of ran a show for Tony. Didn't he get that feeling in this?
I mean, I'd had a good laugh watching it. I liked picking up on wee references that if you've seen The Sopranos a lot, you're going to appreciate, or he said the thing and all that. It was worth ticket price for me.
Junior was good, I thought.
He was
He was good, man, I thought. He done it well. He'd get fleshed out a bit as well as a character, and he was pretty good. The mom was pretty good too. Seeing her when she was younger than that.
She's such a big character as well. She did a really good... Some of the people did a fucking good job. I thought Michael Gandolfini as young Tony was really fucking good as well. But that's hardly surprising. Yeah. But there you go. That's your movie corner.
6 out of 10.
That's maybe fair enough, to be honest. No. Mick, Deltarune Chapter 2. Your eagle-eared listeners will know that me and McCormick are kind of nerds for this Toby Fox guy and his kind of Undertale extended gaming universe. What do you think of Deltarune Chapter 2, which came out for free, was it a month ago? Maybe even like 3 weeks ago, but it feels like longer.
It was only a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, I basically just like wolfed it down, like completed it in an afternoon and evening, and it was brilliant. Couldn't put it down. Yeah, I think it just kind of like it expanded upon all the stuff in the first game pretty well. Introduced a whole load of new characters that are going to be like massive fan favourites, through which I think like Toby Fox just has a unique talent for fucking creating like characters that folk are going to fall in love with.
Aye, or like the Tumblr kids are just going to spend hours and hours drawing. Like, he has an innate ability to just make that.
I know, I loved it, and I feel like there's, like, I kind of did race through it, but I get the impression there's a lot of hidden depths to this one, even more so than the first one. We've heard kind of rumours of, like, a secret boss, a secret ending, all sorts of stuff like that, so it'll definitely be worth playing through again.
There's a kind of a genocide path in this one.
Yes!
Quote unquote, like the old Undertale. But I loved it as well. I think most people would play this in a wanner. Apparently that was the same for the first chapter. They took a survey on playing habits for how people did with chapter one, and apparently broadly people just sat and done it in fucking one sitting.
Yeah, I think it's a bit kind of frustrating because like you're waiting, what was it, about 2 years between chapters. And then you get something that only lasts you about a couple of hours to play through, but I think it was kind of like perfectly formed. But it's kind of giving you some sort of setting up some things for the rest of the series, and both in terms of the story and in terms of like how it's going to work, where you can, you know, choose to befriend or choose to kill the enemies, and then if you befriend them, they're going to show up in your castle, and you can fucking have a chat with them, and they open up shops and stuff like that. A bit like the game we're going to talk about shortly after this, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And you like getting something for nothing as well. I thought it was nice that they put it out for free.
Yeah. Did you have any favourite characters? I was a big fan of the Queen, the baddie in this one.
The Queen was the lancer of this chapter. She got all the best part.
Yeah.
I only play mobile games and all that type of thing. I liked Spamton, the creepy kind of dealmaker guy. I liked the three kind of robot DJs. I thought they were cool.
Oh yeah, they were definitely cool. They were set up as rebels against the system, but they were more interested in like playing tunes and running a shop.
They're sticking curls.
He does.
Well, I mean, I think we all feel that way.
Yep.
But I suppose, unless there's anything else he's particularly wanting to get out the road during our opening bump, he can just get on with the show.
I never got a chance to say last time because Errol was going off in one about Persona, but I finally completed Persona 5 after about 120 hours of gameplay. So I think you've probably heard enough of us talk about that one, so it's going to be another about 5 to 10 years till we hear any more Persona chat for me, I think.
Is that enough Persona to last you a lifetime?
Aye, these games are long as fuck, man, and I love them, but when you finish with them, you kind of, like, I don't feel the urge to play it again like, anytime soon.
On an aside, the Yakuza games are meant to be quite Persona-y now.
Well, they're bringing out a new one, it's an RPG, I think that's the thing.
It's out already, like a dragon or something.
Ah.
Played it, man. I played a bit of it, and it's the Shakuza, but they've took a good bit out. So now it's just like turn based battles, man. But I don't know, the whole point of Yakuza was it was Streets of Rage, wasn't it?
Free roaming, kind of. Like a GTA sandbox style game, but merely an emphasis on your Shenmue style battering cunts.
Aye, it was like Shenmue meets Streets of Rage, but we take that component out of it. I don't know. I know it's a Japanese game, but I don't know. I like the fighting aspect, but I like a bit better. Judgment, I think, is a game for me.
I think they'd been making these games for so long that they just kind of fancied trying something a bit different with them. I think they'd maybe gotten a bit bored.
Aye.
Can you go to a Red Room type place, like a Lynchian Twin Peaks liminal space?
Nah.
And Persona, you go to this wee place called the Velvet Room. And for me, that's a kind of, my headcanon is that's a very much a kind of Red Room type place, you know, with the wee backwards talking fella and that.
Oh, the arm.
Aye.
Bobber.
No, I mean, well, not yet anyway. Hopefully in Persona 6, the main. In fact, well, I mean, Persona 5 had a rapist in it. But anyway, let's get this show on the road. Well, we're kicking off with me, McCormick. Why did you pick? Now, we also need to nail down how we fucking pronounce the name of this game.
Suikoden.
Mahid, it's Suikoden. I hear people also saying Suikoden. But aye, McCormick, why did you pick Suikoden or Suikoden or whatever? Suikoden 2 for me.
I think growing up I called it Suikoden, but Suikoden just sounds better. I don't know fucking anything about Chinese or Japanese, but I'm going to say it sounds more Asian to me, so I'm going to fucking go with it. So basically years and years ago, I went to my cousin Chris's house and he'd rented this game. And I'd kind of never really seen anything like it before. You know, you'd characters on one side of the screen, fighting characters on another side of the screen, numbers coming out, selecting things with menus. It was the first kind of JRPG I'd ever seen. I later found out that's the genre of game it was, but something about it just kind of clicked for me. And we spent a kind of an evening just playing through, and I was loving it, and I thought, I need to kind of find more games like this. Shortly after that, I started playing Final Fantasy VII, and the rest was history. So for about 25 years, I thought that game was Suikoden 2, but it turns out, and I just found this out last week, it was Suikoden 1. So what I'm saying is, Mick, I flinked you, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, just as well, because I'd already played the first gen. And anyway, everybody says that 2 is better.
Yeah, I get that impression as well, and like from looking back, just to confirm my suspicions, like watching a playthrough of the first one, I think the second one does seem a bit better. That aside, I thought Mick would enjoy this game from my memory, Suikoden 1, and I think I probably thought he would enjoy Suikoden 2 even more, since it's highly celebrated. Yeah, go for it.
Well, I'll tell you something about Suikoden 1, first of all, right? I played that maybe 4 or 5 years ago. It wasn't a nostalgia game for me. I played it in my 20s, and it was one of these games that made me realise, here, fucking, I'm not even nearly done with like the PlayStation 1 library.
Yeah.
If this is the first one and the second one's meant to be even better, there's fucking hundreds of shit I've still not played in the PlayStation 1. I never finished Breath of Fire 4 or Wild Arms or anything like that. There's a lot of fucking JRPGs for it.
Aye, that's the golden age for me, I think, of JRPGs there.
I think it beats the Super Nintendo for it, even, in my opinion. It might be. You've got even more, I guess. One of the stranger points about this game, series of games that'll get out the road sharpish, is that
I think we've lost Mick.
No, I'm fucking waiting for Fast and the Furious 5 to finish outside the fucking...
Oh, Reach, it's my house, aye. Fuck, sorry, Al. I'm going to go and shut him in. He's giving me 2 minutes, right? Sorry. Oh, Vin, keep my noise down. It's fucking Dwayne and Vinny at it again, man.
As per. But aye, so one of the fucking stranger points about this fucking series, Suikoden, they're actually based on a fucking 14th century Chinese novel called Shui Huzhuan, or Water Margin. But apparently it's quite a fucking famous thing in Chinese literature. I don't really know much about that. But it deals with 108 outlaws joining forces to overthrow the government, only for them to be recognised as this legendary army who become heroes and then go and fight invaders and go and do all these fucking legendary feats. It might be like a Chinese equivalent to kind of fucking King Arthur type mythology. Do you know what I mean?
I got the impression it was kind of like a national epic, like fucking Beowulf or the Odyssey or something like that. It's kind of that well regarded.
It's considered one of the four great novels in Chinese canon. So I think national epic probably is a great way to describe it. Your man who created Suikoden, Yoshitaka Murayama, he wanted to make a game that had hundreds and hundreds of playable characters in it because he enjoyed fucking manga.
Oh, right.
The likes of Captain Tsubasa and Dragon Ball were two that he mentioned. One thing he liked about that is that they had fucking so many fucking random as fuck crazy characters in them.
I like that about it too, man. I think I get what he means. Yeah.
But he said a kind of stuffy old bigwigs at Konami when they understand. If he came to them and went, oh, we'll make it like a fucking shonen manga, they would be like, what the fuck are you talking about? So he said, it's like this Chinese novel where there was 108 of them. Am I going to make it that you have to collect 108 people? And they went, aye, that's good marketing and stuff. I understand that. Collect all 108. So that's a wee bit of fucking weird background on that for yous. The plot of this one is that you've got a kind of standard War and Kingdoms setting. There's two kingdoms, there's a period of peace about to be entered, and then shit happens and they go to war. I think it's better written than a lot of your standard medieval role-playing games because the setup shows you a lot of the fucking impact it has on humanity, particularly like children.
It felt like kind of a more plausible sort of like scenario with like kind of rooted in sort of like two warring kingdoms and the politics between them and that. It doesn't go like straight into the kind of wizards and prophecies and that. Like it starts off at least quite grounded.
It humanises both sides, you know what I mean? You talk to fucking soldiers on the other and they're no fucking cartoon characters. They're just like, politics of more powerful men has led to them fucking dying in fields. I think it gets that across. Although the translation's a wee bit fucking dodgy at times. I think it's pretty well written.
I thought that the army that you're in to start with were the baddies right away because it appears that you're child soldiers.
Yes, aye. You're part of like the Young Dragon Division or whatever, and they're all like 12.
The Unicorn Division of the Youth Brigade of the Highland Army.
That's it. Who got murdered at the Battle of Culloden. Another part of the setup is that you and basically your brah, your childhood best friend, end up on fucking opposite ends of a war. I guess they set up some nice fucking human conflict there. You want to defeat the evil empire, but you grow to kind of like your wee pal, although he's reasoning behind joining the baddies is fucking stupid.
I've not got that far yet, but it seemed a bit abrupt.
I've put down that he's a liberal, because his response to fucking brutal inhumanity and military fascism basically is to go, could probably change this for the inside. Actually, I'm gonna join that side rather than resisting them in any way. When you get to the actual game, I think part of the reason why I found the first one addictive and this one even more so is the ridiculous number of fucking party members you get, your characters. So a big part of the game is that you're recruiting all these fucking oddballs to join your kind of ragtag resistance army. You get a lot of them automatically if you're just playing through the kind of main story. But the good ones, the best ones, are the wee fucking ones that you can miss. See, if you walk about a town and you talk to everybody, you find somebody and they've got a character portrait and you go, I bet you I can get this cunt to join my army. And then
the best approach is you go to a new toon, you look for the most outlandish looking person in the toon, and you're like, they're going to be a party member. It'll be like, there's like a toon full of like folk in very plain, pleasant dress, and then there's one guy with like spiky blue hair and like a kind of a crazy like medallion on. You're like, he's a party member. Yeah, definitely.
I fucking love that. I'm like, I need to get this guy. What do you have to fucking convince? Usually, you'll talk to somebody or you'll talk to a string of people or get an item or play a stupid wee minigame, and then that'll convince the person to join your side. Eventually, you get a castle and you can build up your castle. Your castle gets shops in it. your castle gets an inn, your castle gets all these kind of different mini-games, but the I liked, and I think McCormick also liked, is that you can get a private eye as one of you guys in your castle. One of the things you can do for him is he can eavesdrop on people and spy on them and tell you how to get them to join your army if you're kind of stuck. If you want spiky hair blue guy to join the army and you just can't work it out, it's nice to not have to just go onto GameFAQs. You can fucking go sling this guy a couple of gold and he goes, right, see blue hair guy, what he really likes is fishing. See if you catch a cracker fish, bet you he'll fucking join your army. And it's like, I like that better than looking up a guide.
Because there's so many of the characters, like, you can tell they've had a lot of fun like designing them all, but, you know, get a wide range, just like the kind of cast of Dragon Ball and stuff, something like that. I know you're a fan of, like, a monster or a non-human party member in a lot of games you've played. I've definitely got that impression for you. There's a plethora of those in this game. All sorts of strange non-human characters.
Oh, aye.
There's a bit five like magical squirrels you can recruit at some point.
You've got different fantasy races as well. You've got kobolds and you've got these flying dudes called wingers. I don't know if elves and dwarfs come into it. I think they might in the first gen. I can't quite remember, or I might be getting mixed up with Breath of Fire.
How do you rate this Suikoden's 2's Aeris moment?
I guess the most shocking moment, without looking at the ending, because I didn't actually get... I was in London for a week, so I've only fucking played maybe halfway through this to maybe three quarters. But the most shocking part is when your best pal betrays you and joins the enemy army. He fucking stabs this woman to death so that the baddies can take over a town. It's pretty brutal.
Yeah, and it spent the whole game building up what an amazing, powerful friendship you have with him and how you've gone through thick and thin and stuff like that. So it's quite shocking when he betrays you.
Does this game have elements of not only JRPG combat, but also strategy combat, Shining Force?
Aye, so as we were saying in the chat earlier, the first gen had these war kind of... The war bits in the first gen, rather than like a fully-fledged strategy RPG, they were like a paper, rock, scissors minigame. Like, right. you could charge, you could defend, or you could fire arrows... and depending on what the enemy unit did, there was a correct response that you could pick. The second one threw that out and went, right, we'll throw in a kind of strategy RPG type thing, like a Shining Force or like a Tactics Ogre or something. But weirdly, at least up to the point that I've got, they don't really let you do anything with it. You get to control one or two units. Most of the fights you kind of lose, and they mostly use them as like cutscenes. But it's bizarre because they have programmed this fucking strategy into it. I mean, McCormick, what did you get out of that?
It seemed like a bit of a missed opportunity. I was wondering maybe if, like, I was thinking, like, later in the game, you might have some optional sort of pitch battles that are more difficult. Or maybe they kind of shat it a bit and thought, like, folk won't be very good at these sections, so we'll make them, like, really easy. But it was weird. Like, I would have liked them to kind of do a bit more with that. The actual regular kind of battle system and stuff I really enjoyed, because you get six party members, which is quite a lot for these type of games, and like everyone kind of takes all their actions simultaneously, so it looks quite cinematic. You know, everyone's kind of, you're not just waiting to take your turn to kind of like slash a sword at somebody, everyone's kind of jumping into the fray. Quite kind of fun to look at. You can kind of customise your characters quite well as well. You get these kind of magical runes that you can apply that gave people different spells and that. So you've got a lot of kind of opportunities to kind of mould your party how you want to. And also, you've got about 108 characters that you can mix and match between, which is fun as well.
Also, it looks a lot more like Chrono Trigger than it does Final Fantasy VII.
Graphically, it's quite... I would say it looks quite a lot like Chrono Trigger, but, you know, maybe in a slightly higher def because it's on the PS1, some nice lighting effects and stuff like that, but it's like really good 2D as opposed to really early 3D.
The fucking series Head Honcho, Yoshitaka Murayama, after Suikoden 1 became a wee bit of a sleeper hit, A, because it's good, and B, because it got in fucking rapid. It actually got in ahead of... You know, the first Final Fantasy game on the PlayStation. Again, I had a lot of other JRPGs. Suikoden was one of the first, and therefore a lot of people ended up playing it. Because that was a wee bit of a fucking unexpected success, Konami were coming to them and going, right, make a fucking null one. And they had a moment where they were thinking, right, do we spend our development time here on making it 3D because Final Fantasy VIII's coming out, all these other things are 3D. 3D seems to be what's happening. Instead, they decided to take quite a Sega approach, really just make their 2D sprites more detailed and flesh out the world and the story more. They spent more of their development on that.
This game would have probably been an absolute beast on the Saturn, man, because Saturn was just amazing at doing 2D. I would have liked to have seen that. I don't know, I've seen games run on the Saturn, I'd just see that anyway.
You look at something like Chrono Trigger, you have your regular kind of overworld sprites. There will also be a sprite of like the character looking shocked or the character laughing or something like that. But there's actually no that many unique sprites. They make quite a lot with a little. And Suikoden 2, there's fucking shitloads of sprites. There's like sprites of the characters doing things that you might only fucking see once. Do you know what I mean? Like drinking or eating or fucking swimming, making all kinds of different expressions, moving in different ways. The graphics are pretty good. And because it's not early 3D, they've got maybe a kind of timeless look about them. They look a lot better.
Aye, yep, definitely. You get that because you look at Final Fantasy VII, man, and it's kind of hard to take them blocky horns seriously. I mean, you still can. But I mean, if you're taking the blinkers off, if somebody goes to that brand new, they might be a bit more critical, you know? Whereas if you look at something like Suikoden, it's still... it's like a good cartoon. You know?
I'll be honest, man. Like even at the time playing Final Fantasy VII, having played other 3D games on the PC, I thought the 3D looked a bit primitive in it. Like it's very early 3D, man. Whereas I think we've probably said this a million times on the show, but the 2D from that era probably holds up a lot better.
Aye,
it's a bit Dire Straits in it. I want my MTV.
Aye, exactly.
Something about a microwave oven. It looks like it's running on one.
Difficulty-wise, this game is fucking well on the easier side of JRPGs. It's mainly a focus on a kind of relaxing gameplay experience and storytelling rather than like hardcore dungeon-crawling bosses that are going to kick your cunt in. I think it works particularly well as... I mean, they are kind of trying to tell an impactful story, but for me, because you get so many of these different characters... who you can try all these different party combinations and different runes, as you were saying, your kind of magic systems, you can equip them to anybody, really. It doesn't penalise you for experimenting.
Yeah.
Every combination kind of works. So I kind of like that about it. And also, if you've got a character who's fucking well behind in terms of levels, they've programmed someone in that if you put them into your party, they just level up fucking rapid. So I enjoyed that as well.
What did you think about the castle and the whole kind of like progression of sort of like getting folk to join your castle and maybe open new wee segments here and new shops and stuff like that? Because I think that's feels quite rewarding doing that.
Everything. I want the fucking full castle. I want to find every character. I want every blue-haired spiky guy to be an option for me. I want all the different shopkeepers. I want even the stuff that doesn't do anything. In the first run, you could get a chef. Who made fucking minted dinners in your castle. And I'm like, where is the chef in this shin? I want my castle to have good fucking scran. I'm a lot more invested in making my castle pure good and finding all the characters, really, than I am in ending this terrible war.
I've got one complaint about the castle. So, like, in the first game, you liberate the castle via a dragon. It's pretty standard. In this one, the castle's previous owner was a vampire, which it's a bit kind of weird, like it's a bit of a weird tone shift when you're fighting this vampire in the game. But you kick him out, and then the castle's yours. But they redecorate the place, man. What happened to all the? I wish they'd fucking kept, you know, the original features. You know, the gargoyles, the bats.
Well, you get an FMV cutscene of him playing this big creepy chapel organ.
Aye.
Where did it go? Did you just move that out? I wanted that.
That must have cost an absolute fortune to fucking move out, man. It's like you're meant to be saving up to fight the war effort, man. You're spending money getting a big fucking pipe organ cleared out of your castle.
It reminds me of Canuck when they build statues and see they're feeding the poor.
Pretty much. But other than that, yes, I do concur. Like I've not played a whole lot of this one. I've only recently got the castle, but I'm wanting to keep playing it afterwards just to start building things up. I think that's almost when the real game starts, when you get that.
Aye, it takes a while to get going. I was into it. I wanted to see what happened, and I was happy playing through it. But the game didn't really get its hooks into us until it was more about building up your castle and recruiting different characters. I think if I hadn't been on holiday for a week, this is one that I would have come into this having finished. But, you know, I think I'm going to try and beat it afterwards. Maybe there will be a sweet good update on a future episode. Another wee bit that I've got here is that apparently this was one of the really fucking brutal, like, crunch developments.
Ah, oh, fuck.
Your man, Yoshitaka Murayama, basically wrote all the dialogue for every NPC and fucking everything by himself, and he said he was living out of his office and started getting hallucinations about the game and things like that.
Jesus.
The lead composer was a woman called Miki Higashino, but she said that she basically found it so grueling that she fucking quit the games industry afterwards.
Jesus.
She says she's really, really proud of her work on it and stuff like that. I actually read an interview with her and she was talking about... This is, again, I think I've talked about this in another RPG we were talking about, but I liked reading about her process for doing the different... the tunes in the game, the tune themes.
Yeah.
She got shown pictures of the different places and the different areas of the map, and she kind of went, right, I think this area is kind of Celtic, this bit looks kind of Arabian, there's a ninja tune, so we'll give that a kind of Japanese motif. And she tried to make music that she thought the people in the towns would hear themselves, that you would get if you were just kind of walking through it. She said that she wanted to create a journey across the world, but with music.
Now, that's quite interesting. I've kind of noticed that, like, the area of the game I'm in now, it's definitely a lot more kind of Asian influence. There's, like, definitely some towns that are more kind of Chinese or Japanese or Korean looking towns.
There's about 105 different tracks on the OST volition as well, which... It's still pretty fucking meaty. It's became more and more common for RPGs as the PlayStation went on, but I, at the time, that was a lot.
Seems like just maybe it wasn't project managed very well. they'd get a composer writing 108 tunes and a producer, like, writing a dialogue for every single character.
You didn't hear these stories about Japan, though, back then. The games industry was, like, brutal. Like, they would have to sleep, like, there, and they just worked to the bone. That magazine Retro Gamer done a piece on... development of Sonic 2, and Yuji Naka left, who we'll be talking about later, left Japan to go and work on Sonic 2 in America, and the Americans said they just fucking couldn't keep up, so he had to bring his team in for Japan to finish the project.
I think Japanese corporate culture is a bit like that anyway, like, so with the games industry, that's probably times 10.
Aye.
Fuck your toilet breaks.
Yeah, so just uncapped capitalism, man. Fucking last alive wins.
I mean, I would say, final thoughts on this, and it's a role-playing game for people who appreciate the journey more than the destination. If you're the type of person who goes to a new tune when you're playing a role-playing game and you want to talk to everybody and examine every kind of wee nook and cranny, you're probably going to get more out of it.
Yeah.
If you're more about following the main storyline and... you know, interesting big battles against bosses and set pieces and stuff, you're still probably going to have a good time with it, but you get the most of it from fucking trying to find every blue spiky-haired man that you can recruit. That is what the game's about, upgrading the castle, playing all the fucking daft wee mini-games, getting immersed in all the different world cultures and that. I think it's a cracker if you're a... Rusty concurs. If you're a JRPG fan in general, it's a must play.
I think it's a hidden, I don't know if it's quite a hidden gem, but it's definitely, like, you don't always see it in kind of folks' top 10 lists and that, so we should get a bit of appreciation.
I think it was in many a wee pile back in the day, or sometimes the first gen. I don't think it was unheard of, but at least for me, it wasn't a part of my childhood or anything, so I've enjoyed looking at it, and as I say, I'm going to continue it.
Me too.
Nice.
That brings us to why I picked River City Ransom, or as it's known here in Europe, Street Gangs. A lot more of a kind of Tesco value title here.
That's a fucking awful title, man.
I know. When you compare it to River City Ransom, do you know what I mean? But anyway, the reason I picked it for Andy is simply that I think it's the best 8-bit beat-em-up ever made. Now, we've got our 16-bit ones that we love, or near and dear, particularly Andy and his arcade ones and stuff. But I thought, looking at something a wee bit earlier and showing that it's still fucking arguably better than some A16-bit ones, or just as good anyway. I basically just wanted to hear his thoughts on it, because I think it's cool as fuck.
Aye, ridiculously innovative for its time. Like, nowadays, we've got standardised open worlds, the game must be open world, and this is a game that does it in the 80s, man, an open world beat-em-up. When I heard about it, I was kind of sceptical. When I read a bit about it, it was like open world beat-em-up, that went, right, just how open can this world be, been on an NES and stuff like that. And I was very surprised with how well done it was. Basically, you're a wee guy that comes out of school in a town plagued with gangs, thinking of young teams, essentially. You've got guys from here, there and everywhere. I didn't pick up many of their names, I was just too busy knocking fuck out them.
You had Old Morag and you had Shell Suit Bob and you had the whole we had to mention it.
Aye, fucking tell you what, man, like, the game plays so well. It's got the crunch I love in beat 'em ups. You get your punch and kick, and the thing about this game is that it's also, not only is it a open world, but it's also got like RPG elements. So if you think about this game's got two distinct parts to it, right? You've got a sort of like dungeon part that kind of is like Yakuza or Streets of Rage or something like that, where you fight hostile enemies who are part of one gang. This may continue for like one or two screens. It might even get into a wee park that's optional or something. But what you'll find is there's a boss of one of these gangs that you can then take out. And every time you batter an enemy, a wee coin bounces on the floor, and you collect these coins in order to go to the next part of the game, which is a mall where there's no hostile enemies. It's sort of like a wee RPG tune. And you can go into every single shop. So it could be like a bookstore, sushi shop. The Chinese is called Mao's. That's very innovative. You can go and you can get power-ups. For instance, I'm thinking about Shenmue here, but you get into antique shops to get new moves. Same thing here, you go into a bookshop to learn new versions of your punch and kick.
Ah, you get karate manuals that'll teach you the dragon fist and things like that.
So you save up these silver coins to go and buy the moves. The moves are usually a lot dearer than things like power-ups that can bring your health up or increase your stats.
There were some of the shops that I didn't end up using at all. You get a couple of the different malls and there's I think there's a record shop that I didn't know what the records. I'm assuming they still put your stats up in some way.
Aye, so you've got an overview of your stats here, and depending on what you buy, as you said, can up your stats. So you've got stamina, strength, speed, just various things like that. And if you buy, let's just say you buy chocolate or something, then what you'll find is, right, okay, so that correlates with health, so that'll put your health up a wee bit. Maybe make you a bit faster and put your stamina up. Whereas if you buy something like a CD or a record, then you might learn a new ability or something.
Also,
you kind of don't know before you. Yeah, you don't know before you buy them what it's going to do.
Nah.
Exactly. So you don't know. You go to the Chinese restaurant and you go, right, I'm a wee bit skint, I'm just going to get some prawn crackers. And then you eat the prawn crackers and it says, actually, prawn crackers slightly improves your kick. Aye. So you go, all right, do I just start fucking scranning hunters or prawn crackers and try to get the strongest kick? You try to kind of build your character around what you find out for buying things at the shop.
Aye. I think one in these games, beat 'em ups, weapons usually make you 10 times stronger, and you usually feel you've got the ultimate power in your hands. Streets of Rage, you would have a big pole, man. You get nothing better than smashing some company a big pole in Streets of Rage. But you get all that here too, but what you find is, once you've learned the fast punch and the fast kick, you're avoiding weapons at all costs because they're just not as effective as your new abilities, man. And you become God with M2 by punch and kick.
There are items that can put a skill called weapon up, but I eventually hit a point in the game where I had the upgraded punch move, and my punch was my highest stat. So I just went, right, fuck it. I'm just going to find everything that increases punch and just beat the game just punching. That's all I'm going to do.
Aye. I got the punch first and then went for the kick. And once you had the two of them, it's kind of difficult to get beat in it. But I'll tell you, I didn't know there was a jump in this game until quite late on. So obviously you need to learn jump at one point. I think you go to, what's it called again?
It's a factory or something, isn't it? A warehouse. It's a warehouse.
Aye, so it's a warehouse you get. And you know, it's kind of pink in colour. And you see these boxes, and you hit up your dead end, and you're like, ah, how the fuck did I get back? What did I do here? I had to say to you, like, what did you do? And you're like, try and press the two A and B button together. Because I'm playing this on a phone, right? It's them kind of fucking touch controls. It's difficult to get the fucking emulator to realise that you're pressing B and A at the same time.
Aye.
And the fact that a jump is a wee bit floaty and like, you bounce halfways, that's another thing. If you're jumping right and you're too close to the edge, it'll bounce you backwards. So it's like, hold on, what the fuck am I doing here? But I think even then, you can buy a power up that lets you do a Sonic the Hedgehog jump.
Oh, really?
I swear. So once you get that, it's no bother.
Amazing.
And did you experience one of the most gutter things in this game where you've been getting into a big stramash with one of the young teams, right? The squids or the cowboys or the jocks or something.
Aye.
And you're down to one health, not even one health bar, you're at zero health, but your guy's still fucking barely stoning.
Aye.
And you double tap to run away, and you can actually run into a wall.
And then it tells you. Fuck off. Aye. Aye, that's a pain in the arse, that. Aye, so you. Aye, so basically, this game, the difficulty comes from the fact that you lost all your money. If you get battered in a dungeon, so you go back to the previous mall you were at with no money essentially, so you need to go and pay it again. But sometimes you can try and be fly about it and say, right, I'm just going to fight on for a wee bit here. I know I'm nearly dead, but I'm going to just try and get maybe two more coins and then I'll make a fucking mad dash for it back. But as Mick says, man, I better hope there's no fucking brick walls there. Because if you make one false move, then you've lost all your power, as the game says, and that's you fucked. Right, now, this game, I got quite far in it, man. There was a point where, just before I went down to Wales, I was playing it constantly and just, I was enjoying it and I got too strong. And then I got to the bit where there's a bit called Pop's Health Club.
Aye.
Which is like, it's got a sauna and stuff. That's just before a dungeon where it's outside a high school. For some reason, I didn't know where to go after that, so I could only get to this high school and the back of me. I could batter everybody, I could go through the whole open world, but I couldn't get into a high school, unfortunately, and I was gutted, because I really didn't know where to go.
My suspicion is, you've got to beat, after you've fought your way that far, you get a gang of bosses, and there's four of them, and you need to find all four of them and battle them, and after you've beat them, when you go to the high school, a guardian comes out, this guy's guarding the baddie high school. And then you can batter him and go into the high school and do the rest of the game.
Where would I find the four baddies? Because I was looking for them everywhere. I couldn't find them anywhere. I was in parks and everything. Trying to get any blogs. Need cigar.
You got to go to the park. There's one in the warehouse, I think. There's one in the factory. Sometimes as well, if you're in an area, you need to batter enough normal wee guys. And then the boss music will start playing and then the boss will come out.
Aye, because so they just bounce out randomly, didn't they, sometimes? It's like,
aye.
They're just punching fuck at accounts and then the music will change. Don't with some fucking, a guy with a different t-shirt on or something.
Aye.
Once you've got the kick and the punch, the rapid, I don't know, but in my head it's saying, say Tiger's Punch, but I know that's not what it's called.
So, it's something like that.
Aye. But once you get that, like, you're God, man, ain't you? And the wee guy, the boss, once he hits the deck, you time it right. He gets back up again and just boot him right back in his fucking arse, man.
Well,
you make quite easy work, guy.
No, most of the bosses are piss easy. I would say the bosses are a lot easier than some of the tougher gangs, because if they mob you and you've got one on either side, they can kick fuck out you.
Is it because you can kind of grind and build up to them?
Well, they don't even really need it once you get them kicks and punches, because... And then it just becomes timing. That's a good thing about these games. Like, seeing a JRPG, well... It's more about like strategy and all that, whereas in like beat 'em ups and like kind of use kind of side scrolling RPGs, it's more about like timing and stuff. It incorporates more real time play.
I mean, if you were good enough, you could beat this game without buying any upgrades. Do you know what I mean? It's still beatable without fucking gaining yourself more defense or more punching power or whatever.
I actually played a game like this before on the Mega Drive, Wonder Boy and Monster World. And what it is, it's just it does the same sort of thing, but with platform games. So it creates like an open world. You can go into shops, power up your character, new weapons and all that. So I'm wondering, like, obviously this came well before that. This must have been one of the first games to do this. Absolutely fucking innovative shit, man, aye.
This is 1989, right? And it's an open world action game with RPG elements, right? You fast forward 30 years, fucking every AAA game is an open world action game with RPG elements.
Yeah, exactly.
It's prefigured fucking just about everything from fucking Assassin's Creed to Destiny to like Red Dead Redemption and all that. I think they can all kind of descend for this one.
Says it all. And it's also got that addictive thing. Like, I know some games have just got a wee addictive thing in it. It'll keep you coming back. It's satisfying, like, knocking fuck out of wee guys in us. Just the animations and, like, the collision. Even the graphics, man, the graphics are fucking good. I mean, I've seen games on 16-bit consoles that are fucking 10 times worse than us.
You get your wee bit of gratification out of picking up a coin. See, when you've killed a guy, got to get a coin. See, if you're not quick enough and a coin disappears, nothing worse.
Aye.
See, I didn't really know that beat-em-ups were a thing in the 8-bit era. Like
Ninja Gaiden, wasn't it, and stuff?
Well, Double Dragon was the... That's the same mob. Double Dragon was the arcade smash. Well, if you want to go into that, I've got a wee bit of note here because I know Andy's into his beat-em-ups, possibly your favourite genre of games, maybe football games, I'm not sure. This is part of a series of games that are called the Kuneo series in Japan, and they were all based on this fucking juvenile delinquent guy. The first game in the series was an arcade game called Niketsu Koha Kuneo-kun, which translated as Hot-Blooded Tough Guy Kuneo, which was just a fucking arcade beat-em-up where you were a guy in a fucking Japanese schoolboy uniform punching fuck out of cunts, just fighting with other delinquents. That was localised in the West as a game called Renegade.
Oh, they called it Rab.
if you know your stuff about the history of beat-em-ups, Renegade was one of the fucking first biggies. The Western version's actually pretty cool as well. The Warriors was a big movie at the time.
Aye,
so that was why they decided to throw all these kind of New York gang aesthetics into it. But then,
oh, that'd be cool, man. See if this game kind of incorporated all the different styles of gangs, like the baseball nasties.
Aye.
The rest of them again. That's one thing a game is missing. The baddies were maybe a wee bit generic. Maybe that's a limitation of the system. Aye, got them in good, man.
In the Japanese version, they're off at different schools, and they all wear different coloured school uniforms.
Ah, well, that's all right.
The Western one changed everybody to be wearing jeans and T-shirts. And
it was either Specky guy, bushy eyebrows guy, and I think there was one more, I can't remember, but it was basically them with different types of T-shirt on. But it's a fucking Nintendo, you know? It's the first Nintendo. You've got to remember, man, this game is vibrant as fuck, and this is a console that... I mean, if you think about the first Mario, you know, it's just a blue screen. It's quite very kind of bare bones graphics-wise, isn't it? And then you've got this kind of very vibrant game. All right, it was probably a late NES game, but still to be using 8-bit architecture, it's really impressive, you know? Well,
apparently, the tail end of the 80s and, like, 1990 in that, in America, this one, you couldn't get a holiday in the video shop for fucking love nor
that,
money.
It was
rented like fuck.
I was reading a wee guy, I'll need to send you the article, but basically it was about this wee guy that fucking heard, just like us in the playground, had a bit of, River City Ransom had a bit of a kind of mythical kind of status, and all the boys used to run to a fucking video shop to try and get it first at the weekend. And that's actually quite a good article. I never ever got to play it. So in his head, he was in this big open world, 3D, massive open world and all that, in his head. So I wonder what he thought when he actually played it on an emulator.
So, I'll tell you can get overpowered, and once you've sussed out how to beat the bosses, you know, as soon as they start up, just do your rapid punch or rapid kick again, you think you've got a game sussed out, and then a second last boss, a penultimate villain, is the twins. You get to the top floor at the fucking enemy high school, and the fucking theme tune for Double Dragon starts playing.
Ah.
And these two cunts burst out of a classroom, and they're called like Billy and Jimmy, whatever the fucking Double Dragon cunts are called. And fighting two bosses at once is actually fucking hard. I think I died about four times on them, whereas no other boss really gave me that much of a problem. But I just thought that was cool.
Another interesting thing is, too, that if you pick up a weapon, right, you can go to the mall and you've still got a weapon, like maybe a big bin in your head or a pole or something. See if you done that in real life, man, fucking walking through the mall with a fucking bin, you'd be fucked.
I read actually that the creator of this game kind of based it off his own experience in school, like it's kind of semi-autobiographical. Like imagine he was your boss, man, this fucking Kunio-kun, big fucking scrapper.
But also, right, because he's like, I based it on my own experiences. See, when I read him saying that, I was like, no, you didn't, but that's not... see if you were the best fighter in your school, you wouldn't be making computer games. You weren't the toughest guy at school, but you wanted to be.
Also, there's some parallels with your Humbleweed doing Greenock in this game.
Oh, aye.
There's Oak Hill Mall. You get the Oak Mall. And there's Waterfront Mall, too. So,
well, the whole game is set along a river. I mean, aye. Really... If you wanted to do some kind of ROM hack and make just a boys game, the game, this might be a good place to start.
That'd be class, man. You could have like Gibby versus a Strone and all that.
Get Donkey McCafferty at the end.
Tap Ben versus a Waterman, no. Oh, fuck, aye. What a game that would be.
So is this set in a kind of former Japanese shipbuilding tune then?
Well, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them tunes. Yokosuka and all that.
The Greenock of the Far East.
I mean, that was where all the shipbuilding jobs went, wasn't it? Germany and Japan.
Aye. See, this is why playing Shenmue is actually quite educational. Because you learn that Greenock is actually not that unique at all. There's water, there's shipyards.
It's just slightly more martial arts than some other parts of the world, but same social situation.
They've got fucking Master Chen and we've got fucking Watson's Gym.
I like the two main characters in the Western version that you play, there's not really much to them. They're just called like Alex and Ryan or whatever. In the original, they're Kunio, who, again, is this fucking just mad cunt, toughest guy in a school, fighter type guy. And then the other guy is kind of a spoff, but it's his bird that's been kidnapped by the rival high school. So he needs to go to Kunio and go like, ah, look, mate, fucking help us out here. And he goes, I'll do it, but just because I want to smash cunts, I'm not interested in helping you for the sake of it.
Aye, I'll tell you what, man, I enjoyed this one. I always say when I enjoy one of the games I get, and I did. Good idea, one, as you said, one of my favourite genres, kind of fused with different genres as well, and really done well. I enjoy this a lot more than I enjoy Yakuza games, for instance.
Aye.
It's the same sort of idea, but aye, I really liked it, and I thought the beat-em-up mechanics were really good too, graphics good. I had never had much of music on because I was playing it handheld, and I didn't want to be sitting on a bus and couldn't no one playing Metal City Ransom.
Well, Mick, if you throw in just a generic, see the background music, man, it's like this kind of wee chiptune kind of rockabilly song, and it doesn't really get that annoying. It's still a banger, like even towards the end of the game. I wanted to play the original one just for the podcast because we talk about the old school and all that. On a Game Boy Advance, there is a fucking enhanced port of this.
Nice.
Where they added in extra shit, including that you could recruit cunts to your gang.
There they go, man.
You could batter a gang enough that they turn around and went like, ah, look, we'll fucking help you. And then there was an option to phone them up or something and they would come and help you fight. Apparently the GBA version's pretty fucking good.
I never ever thought I'd see a scheme jumper mechanic in a game.
I'd also recommend the Scott Pilgrim versus the World beat-em-up, which was heavily influenced by River City Ransom. I've not played the original, but I know that game's got like kind of shops to increase your stats and all that as well.
That Plus, game was in a fucking weird limbo for ages. Is there a place you can actually play it now?
Aye, because it was on the Xbox Live Arcade or Xbox 360, but then you couldn't download it off the store for ages. I think there has been a re-release of it. Let me just check, because... Yeah, they were talking recently about it kind of being brought onto, maybe it was Steam or maybe it was one of the other marketplaces, but I think you maybe can get a hold of it now. Aye, so yeah, it re-released for PS4, Xbox One, Switch, and Windows. So you can finally fucking play it again.
I liked playing as a... What'd you call her in it? The manic pixie dream girl, Ramona Flowers.
Yeah.
She got a big mallet like Amy Rose.
Again, my worst pixie dream girls, didn't you, Mick?
well, there's only one Maoist pixie dream girl, and she's in Shenmue 2. But
don't mind Shenmue, she's all right, man. She gives you a roof over your head and that, when they can't else much to know, you know.
Well, and also she fucking loves killing landlords. So we do like her here.
Come on, Suzuki, man. I know you, Suzuki, listens to us religiously. So fucking get that released, man. Come on, the saga must end.
Well, lads at GCHQ, maybe can put us in touch with him.
Right, well, Andy, unless you've got any final thoughts, I guess that mention of another Sega legend can bring us on to our final game, unless you've got anything else to say.
It's actually a lovely segue, and no, all I've got to say is I thought this one was extra special because I really enjoyed it, and I liked the ideas behind it. I thought it was good, impressive.
I'll maybe show you where to find that other boss then, so that you can complete it and see the ending, because it's not a long game either.
Aye, I'm up for that, man. Sounds good. Aye.
But Andy, why, other than the fucking obvious, have you chosen Nights into Dreams for Mr. McCormick?
Ah, well, to tell you that story, I need to take you back to the ripe old year of 1995.
Of course.
The genesis of the Sonic drought. Now, obviously... Sonic 3 and Knuckles came out, and that was the last game. Ugh, unfortunately, it still brings a tear to my fucking eye today. But that was the last sort of... That finished the Death Head saga. There was nowhere else to go with it. You know, Knuckles had found out who the true enemy was. You know, Sonic and Tails had restored power to the floating island, and Robotnik had been blew up in Doomsday Zone without a hope in hell in the world. That was him, he was gone. And it was all over. It was all over, the saga was over. So, where do we go from there? Well... You too, aka Yuji Naka, thought to himself, I'm going to fucking take the idea of Sonic, the speed, the fluidity, and momentum, and I'm going to take it to the Saturn and create a brand new IP. But I'm not going to just do that. I'm going to get a fucking, the most Japanese presentation that I can. And we ended up with Nights into Dreams for the Sega Saturn. That's pretty much why.
This is a kind of period where I think there'd been a few attempts to kind of like bring Sonic to the Sega Saturn that was kind of languishing in development hell for a long time. So unfortunately, you never got a kind of mainline Sonic game for the Sega Saturn, but you got this instead, which is pretty interesting on its own. So Knights is a character somewhat like Freddy Krueger or Jimmy Savile because he resides within the dreams and nightmares of children. He's a kind of rebellious former soldier of a guy called Wise Man. Wise Man, he rules the kingdom of nightmares, basically, nightmares and dreams. And he had it to himself and his minions for a long time, but then humans started falling asleep, and because they've got a consciousness, they can travel to this realm. So he wasn't very happy about it, and he started basically like creating nightmares for humans. He used his realm as a method of like stealing the ideas and concepts of humans, with the ultimate goal of locking humans out of this world forever. So Knights wasn't very happy about that. He rebelled against things, but. He was put in prison for his transgressions, and the only folk that can rescue him are two young kids. I believe they're called Claire and Elliot. Wee lassie and a wee boy, and they are unique because they're lucid dreamers. They can be conscious, you know, within the world of dreams, much like many people can in real life.
Very interesting. It's actually
well. See, just to interject there, Andy, I seem to remember. That you had a wee bit of an obsession with lucid dreaming.
He did.
Would you attribute that to Nights?
Aye, one time I woke up in the middle of the night, and I couldn't move, and I tried to scream, and I just went.
But then sleep paralysis.
Then I found I could roll, and I could look back and see myself sleeping. And I know that I know that I've been known to talk about a shite in my time, right? But this is God's honest fucking truth. And this kept happening. And this was about the time when I started taking MDMA. So fucking, and I kept getting it and getting it and getting it and getting it. And then all of a sudden, I had a eureka moment in my old room, right? I could still picture it now. It kind of looked distorted and a bit more grey, but it was still my room. And I remember, this is the bit that blew my fucking mind, right? I said, fuck it, I'm going to get right through the roof. And I went through the roof, right? But I went through my fucking loft and then into the sky, and I'd never, ever seen my loft in real life.
So you reckon you were doing a bit of astral projection then?
And I still haven't seen it because I'm shitting myself in case it looks the same. It's pretty freaky, man. But no, that's just a bit of serendipity. That's getting nothing to do with nights into dreams.
Well, whether or not it's like just a world created by your own subconscious, or whether your spirit is actually travelling outside your body, is a bit of an open question for the philosophers. But it's a weirdly high concept for what this game actually is, but I found it kind of interesting. So as Andy was saying, this is your kind of your main kind of guys that were foundational to creating Sonic. They brought us this one. You get Yuji Naka, Takashi Iizuka, Naoto Oshima, all these folk that brought us Sonic, decided to do something a bit new with this new 3D console on the Sega Saturn. It's an unusual game. Like, you might, if you weren't familiar with it, think, oh, they've made a platformer, a 3D platform, but it isn't a platformer. I guess I could best describe it as like a score attack game. So how it works is, you start off as one of these two kids in this world of dreams, and Knights is kind of sitting there. Knights is this kind of androgynous, sort of purple, almost kind of jester-like creature, but he can fly. He's very acrobatic.
Sleep paralysis sufferers will know it as the old hag.
Yeah, well, Andy's claimed that his sleep paralysis demon looks remarkably like Vivi from Final Fantasy IX.
Aye, I get the going eyes and the hood. That's what I get.
So these are distinct from the goblin creatures that you see on DMT, the cyber elves.
Oh, the machine elves. Machine elf race. The machine elf race are for the Andromeda galaxy, you see, whereas I think the ones I see are from the Zeta Reticuli.
Right. Of course, and the Nordics fit into this somehow as well, but we're veering wildly off topic.
It all grays.
So you start off as one of these kids, and then you can walk over to where Knights is imprisoned, and you free him. That kicks off a timer. So what you have to do before the time runs out is you have to fly around in four directions. It's kind of 2.5D. You can move it up, down, left and right, but you're kind of flying through like a 3D course, like in a fixed sort of loop around this level. You've got to collect 20, I think, of these wee blue things called chips, and you use those to fly into a thing called an idea capture, which frees an idea that's been stolen by these nightmare creatures.
Or the next bit of your level.
Yeah, and then you fly back. This takes you into a bonus mode where you can collect things as well, but the game are points. So you try and get as many points as possible in this mode before you can travel back to the start of the level, and that kicks you on to the next level, which is it's still in the same 3D arena, but it's like a different path that weaves through it. So the kind of goal of the game is not necessarily to complete the level, although that's what you kind of want to do first, but you complete the level. And then your score will come up and it will say, all right, you got a D. So it's not just about completing it. It's about scoring enough points to get a high rank, beating the boss in a good time, which makes sure that you don't drop down in rank. And then you have to complete two sets of four levels, one for each character, with a good score before you can move on to the next one. So, yeah, the real game is in kind of mastering these things, figuring out the kind of secret to kind of blast through the levels in plenty of time, get loads of points. It's mastery over the levels more than just completing it. So in a way, it's a bit like something like maybe like a Tony Hawk game or something, or like extreme sports almost, where you're trying to find the right path, like the optimal path through the level, and you've got a kind of combo meter, so you're wanting to like constantly be scoring points and kind of racking up big combos and that.
It's kind of it's got a kind of a rhythm game aspect to it. Like you go out to try and do everything in a fluid motion. And as you like, sort of are successful in that, like the tempo of your hits will rise. It's like everything's all related to sound and and imagery in this game, and like you get through these rings, and if you continue to get through them without any breaks in the rings, like another big hit on Superman 64, then you essentially rack up the points which you then need to get at least a C grade, which will then allow you to move on to that section's boss. And you can see at least. But the easy way to do that is, if obviously you get the rings, but you get a blue and yellow ring, which gives you special abilities for about 10 seconds, and it plays a wee tune. And if you can do as many tricks as you can with your shoulder buttons while you're flying about, then you can rack up the points, and you can usually get a B and an A. That's his trick, essentially.
Yeah.
When you've got these ideas that you're free, are they just abstract, nondescript power-ups, call ideas? Or are they like egalitarianism, or you know, like nihilism?
Yeah, that would make put things in more of a like Disco Elysium direction, which would be quite cool.
I think it's more kind of just pick these blue boys up.
Aye, there's
like that.
Yeah, there's five of them. Well, there's four that you have to collect. One that you're always holding on to, because the one that they kind of take away from you is your courage. And that's what keeps you going. So you've always got the red one. Through each level, you've got to get white, which is purity. Blue is intelligence. Green is wisdom and growth. And yellow is hope. So apparently it was influenced by the ideas of Carl Jung and Sigmund Freud, which, if you can believe it, it doesn't.
Also, for some, and I thought this was pretty cool too, like, if you run out of, you basically got a set time as knights, to which you've got to complete the next stage of the level.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you turn back into Clarice or Elliot, and you've got to negotiate the terrain of the dream level, which I think's cool as fuck, man, because it brings a totally different dimension. But then, one of the cool things is that if you're only Clarice or Elliot, then this fucking kind of conspicuous alarm clock chases you, gives chase, and if it catches you, it ends the dream, and it's game over.
So you wake up.
Alarm clock's like the baddie of the level. You've got to try and escape. It's like a fucking cat and moose kind of thing.
Mick, did you beat Nights into Dreams? And as a follow up, Andy, have you completed it in the past?
Completed it many times. I got my Saturn for £15 out of game, and I think it was about 2003, well before fucking all the prices shot up. I remember being up in GeForce with McCormick, maybe just after that. And I had a pure debate about where to spend my pocket money on nights, remember, Michael?
Yeah, I was like trying desperately to convince you to buy it, because you might not have that chance again.
And I got it, and we went back to mine, and I think we got up to Wise Man.
So what we did that time, because you didn't have a memory card in your Sega Saturn, so I think we played through all the levels the first night, didn't get a good enough score in all of them, left the console on overnight because you couldn't turn it off, and then the next day managed to get to the C or above rank in all the levels and get to Wise Man and fight him a few times, but you were so raging fighting him that you rage quit and switched it off, like wiping the memory of the game that we'd been playing for the past 2 nights.
Oh, just a brain fucking thing. I think I just get so sick of you, guy, man.
I did manage to beat all the levels, but as I've said, the true mastery is being able to get like a decent rank at the end of each of the levels, which sadly I didn't manage.
Did you rage quit on the boss as well?
No.
I had the control pad.
I mean as a grown man.
I beat all the bosses, but that's not enough to see you through. You have to actually
get good marks.
Yeah, you have to get good marks in all 8 of the levels to make it to the final boss, and that's what I've not achieved yet.
Oh, fuck. Also, I just remembered, Suikoden 2 has a character called Marx in it. Can't believe we didn't mention it. Just because I've said Marx so many times, it unlocked something in my head.
Spoiler alert, he dies a tragic death, sadly, but his ideas live on. I've kind of explained like vaguely how this game works, but it doesn't really get across the actual like feeling of playing it in motion. Like, it's impressive to kind of look at, you know, the levels are all really colourful, and there's always kind of interesting things going on. It's always like that kind of like the best kind of 3D Sonic levels are kind of like a roller coaster where you're always kind of jumping into some kind of new situation or new kind of gimmick. Like,
it's got a lot of Sonic in it, man. And Aye, it's, I don't know, there's another game that's kind of like this too, called Reister. It's got sections in it. It's kind of like this a wee bit too.
Yeah, I think Sonic Team are good at that, just kind of like propelling you through all these like kind of mad situations so fast you kind of can't catch a breath. Like there's sometimes the kind of perspective changes and it like pop down. Cool, you're going through a maze. I think my favourite one is the snow level where you play as Elliot, where like on the fourth stage it briefly transforms into a snowboard. And you've got to kind of go through a half pipe sort of tunnel thing, and you're kind of banking from left to right to pick up the ideas.
Essentially Beetlejuice, you can like shapeshift and all that. You can do whatever you want.
But it's satisfying, like just kind of linking all your moves together. You know, you're going through kind of obstacle courses, swinging on things, picking up these chips to get points. You've got a special move as well called a paraloop, where if you do a loop the loop, it creates like kind of black hole that sucks in enemies or chips and stars to get points.
Knights is a bit of a progressive. Oh, we say Knights is a he, but he's a bit of a progressive character, because it doesn't matter if you go with Clarice or Elliot, you just go Knights essentially, and Knights is about as androgynous as you get.
So Knights is non-binary, I guess. They're a they.
Aye.
I'm hoping I'm not kind of accidentally misgendered Knights through this, but yeah, definitely non-binary, that completely androgynous character.
Flies about and does a lot of kind of flamboyant stuff, and you can't really tell. Nothing's really masculine about him, nothing's really feminine about him. It's just kind of sits in the middle and just does acrobatics, man. Quite cool. In fact, that's an art. It's very circus like, and it takes a lot of things for it. Was Cirque du Soleil?
Cirque du Soleil, aye.
Another part of this game too is the bosses are quite. I've not really played anything like, and we've got to grab onto them and essentially boot them.
Aye, all the bosses have got a kind of different gimmick, and they all do have this kind of circus sort of theatrical appearance to them. There's one kind of the most iconic one in the game, kind of is like a big, kind of like the, you know, the Valkyrie, the famous kind of Valkyrie from the Ring cycle, but it's like kind of like a cross between that, but like a big floating ball that's kind of bouncing about you, and you've got to kind of like dash into her, loop round and spin, and kind of like charge her through walls and stuff.
And that thing, that bot has got a lot better ball physics than the new fucking Pez, man. Honestly,
it's fucking shit. Good, decent control over it. There's another one where there's this kind of cat thing that's kind of bouncing about these little, they look like mice but they're also dynamite, so he's setting these things alight and you've got to put them out in time before they come and get you.
Right, so you've got kind of puzzle bosses in the vein of like a classic Crash Bandicoot or something like that.
It's
a lot of Crash Bandicoot in the boss fights for sure. Aye, definitely. But everyone's like the same set piece, so like, yeah, I always found that the difficulty in this game comes for boss stages, because the timing aspect is like how you get beat or how you keep going. The boss will just keep fighting you forever and ever, but every time you get hit it takes like about 20 seconds off you, and if you get a zero it's a bit like Doomsday Zone for Sonic 3 and Knuckles.
I find that quite stressful in the when I'm playing a game. You know, sometimes I don't think any of us claim to be particularly fucking amazing. I think Andy's maybe the best in terms of just sheer skill, hand-eye coordination, but I don't think any of us are claiming to be like major league gamers or anything like that. Man. So sometimes when I'm playing something and I can just about do it, I'm like, right, phew, let me go on to the next bit. To ask me to then do it well, you're maybe asking too much of me.
Aye, and I think that is the crux of Knights, because, you know, as I say, no matter how many levels you complete, if you don't do them well, you're not getting at the final boss. And the thing with the bosses as well is that it gives you the impression at the end of each boss that you're getting a multiplier on your points based on how quickly you beat the boss. But what it actually is that your points can only go down if you beat the boss too slowly. So, like, even if you get a C rank in the main stage, if you don't beat the boss quick enough, those points will go down and down until you get a D, and then you've not actually finished the level properly.
Aye.
So not only do you have to master the level and how to get enough points in the level, but you've got to master beating the boss pretty sharply in order to keep those points.
Also, this game came out with a special controller. It later inspired the Dreamcast control pad, but it was known as a 3D controller for the Saturn, and it's that kind of big disc. Ugly motherfucker.
The 3D controller was like, it's the first, or one of the first, like, analog joypad, like, it had a joystick, analog joystick controller, which is like,
I mean, can I see a point?
You'd never really seen that, like, even the PS1, like, the original controller for that just had the D-pad.
You didn't have many games that needed an analog stick, but Knights definitely does, man. Because like,
I did.
The fluidity of the movement, and because it's all about making circles into it, I suppose.
Yeah, the game kind of like makes more sense if you look at it as like a way to show off having an analog stick, because it's all about, yeah, you know, as you say, like fluid movements and loop the loops and all that. So like that's kind of that. It's basically like mastering that as the game almost.
We played Knights without one of them, and God, I would hate to do that. Go back and play with just the regular.
your thumbs were never the same after
it's
that.
Not directional buttons, is it, to play Knights with just a normal pad?
Mick, how did you play it this time around? Was it a Steam port or something that you had, or what were you on?
Oh, I was going to say, because I know we're big fans of emulation in this podcast, but I have made a few exceptions because, you know, if a game is available on Steam, maybe a remastered edition, usually that's the preferred way to play it, Planescape Torment being a prime example.
Yeah.
The Steam port of Knights into Dreams is fucking shite. Do not buy, don't waste your money on it.
What's wrong with it?
I couldn't set up the controls in the way I liked. I couldn't make it have any higher resolution than like 640 by 480, like fucking something really tiny, and it was windowed as well. Like, I couldn't play it full screen.
No.
Apparently there's ways to go in and change it, but like on a PC, I guess as modern as mine, like the settings just didn't work. So
was it a Saturn version?
It's a Windows port or of some description, but it's just not a very good one. I actually ended up playing it on emulator just because, like, I've already used the Saturn emulator to play Virtua One and Mazes of Goon Saga, so I've got it all set up, and I'm happy with how it works. And, like, that was just a much more pleasant experience playing with that. I could use my Xbox 360 controller, obviously get your analog stick and that. So, like, yeah, like, another win for emulation, man, because Sega have put out a few shite PC ports in their time, this being one of them.
Saturn emulation's pretty good now, and there's nothing wrong with that version. Aye, well, kind of Knights broke my heart. I love them. I love them. But, man, they broke my fucking heart. And I'll never forget, I was putting up in your house Clotter Day. And he says, oh, here, I've got a new Knights game.
It was Aero.
Young Aero, was it?
Me and you were at a James Watt College in fucking day in hires, but we were maybe like 19 and
I didn't
just
get any hires that year.
Drinking cans and smoking hash or whatever. Oh no, you hated hash. That's not an ironic comment. Young Andy Mack was all about uppers.
Aye.
As opposed to modern day Andy Mack.
Studying kids. Don't fucking follow my lead.
But we had a wee bit of a, I can't remember, we'd always drank together, but we were pals at this college course, and we went back, we played through Toe Jam and Aero together and all that. So we were hanging about and playing computer games, and we were at my mum and Feather's house, and my wee brother still stayed with them, and he had a Knights sequel on the Wii, and I'd heard Andy talk about Knights many a time, so we were like, let's go up and have a shot at it. And Andy, you take it away. What happened when we got to the old clock at the household, and you fired this thing up?
Caught me off guard, man. I think now you're bringing it back, I can remember. So I mentioned that, I think it was Aero. I says, aye, Knights, aye, cool. He says, oh, I've got a fucking sequel. And I says, there's a Knights sequel. What? I says, aye, that can either go great or it can go fucking horrible. Unfortunately, it was very much the latter, because the game came on. Thankfully, the game is saved by a nice port to the original. But the new game, man, not even 10 seconds passes, and he's talking in a voice that doesn't. It's not Knights, man. That's not Knights' voice. Come on, the fuck.
It's Michael Jackson-esque, isn't it?
Oh, it's bad, man.
Andy didn't like Knights being English.
Oh, no, it's not that, right? What I would say, it's because of that. No, it's not. What it is, I think, I just says a lot about me. See, if I see like a character and it's mute, it doesn't matter if it's like in a comic, or it could be like even just a book, a description of a character, I get a thing that I'm quite comfortable with. Okay, that's what he sounds like in my head, in my mind's eye, my mind's ears, whatever. But that was just the polar opposite.
I remember on the way up, you were fucking going like that. See they fucking Wii motion controls. See if you did that right with a Knights game, it would be the fucking best thing ever. It would be like it would be like what the motion controls were meant to do. But they seem to get a lot wrong in the sequel. I mean, the voice was just the first bit, and then he didn't like a lot about the game, I don't think.
No, and Knights is one of them games, right, that should stand alone. I mean, I'm trying to think of an equivalent.
It's a cult classic, isn't it?
It sits on its own, aye. And there is other games like it. They just kind of evade my thoughts, you know. Classics, but books of art that there's not much like very, very like unique. And Knights is one of them. And I reckon the second one, it tried to bring its own kind of innovative points, but it was just adding shit that didn't need to be added to a Knights game. They could have went and made their own fucking game, or they could have took Fred Flintstone and fucked him up or something. You know what I mean?
Aye. The first one stands on its own. I mean, it's not even... It didn't need any extra padding, you know, like, you know, cutscenes, story, like RPG elements and stuff, which I've not actually played the second Knights, but that's generally how they add a bit of runtime to these things, isn't it?
The audio track in this game today, man, was kind of haunting. It was haunting a wee bit. Like, it was all like,
This is something that I'm surprised at for a McCormick segment. Particularly given that we're talking about a classic Sega game, is it we've had no talk of the tunes?
Aye.
The tunes are good. They're not a million miles away from like a Sonic soundtrack, you know, quite upbeat, poppy, a wee bit jazzy.
Some of it's like trippy.
The boss themes actually take a bit of a turn. Like some of them are quite kind of operatic. But when you're kind of buzzing through the levels, it's very breezy and very kind of that kind of 90s pop that you got for some of the Sonic games around that time.
Even that, not just the music, like the sound effects are all very much part of the physical aspect of the game as well. Like if you react with something on the screen, then it might have a different sound effect if you react with something else.
Yeah, that whole kind of synesthetic kind of experience, you know, all your senses blending together.
And there's a lot of purples and blacks and things that just kind of trippy, maybe subdued, kind of...
Well, dreamlike.
Dreamlike, aye.
I guess that's the point.
And it captures that essence, you know, I've been in a dream, it captures it perfectly, and when you get fucking the PS2 chilling out, fuck off. No, I'm sorry, I'm just going to say fuck off, right? That's it. But I'm saying my piece.
Right, so there's two things about Knights which are worth covering that I've not mentioned yet. The first are the Knightopians, which were... a kind of early attempt at like an artificial life kind of thing. Like you can see the sort of like inception of the Chows for the Sonic Adventure series in this. But this is a very incredibly detailed sort of like complex system they've programmed out of this game that I think 99% of players just will only see. It's very, very strange. So there's like, as well as the kind of enemies, the Nightmarians are called, kicking about each level. There's also these little guys called Knightopians. And... you can, things that you do in the level can either make them happy or sad. If you slow down to go past them, they'll kind of wave at you. And then if they're all happy with you, they'll sing you a wee song. But like if you bump into them or even kill them by accident, that obviously makes them all really angry.
What is this? This is fucking Black and White or whatever that fucking game was called. Like what?
Oh, what? We've got this notion that we can... I'm gonna get...
Or what am I talking about, that God Sim thing?
That's the one, aye. Knight, Black and White.
I mean, is Knights the god of the Knightopians?
He is a Knightopian. I think he's a Knightopian that... how's the fucking, like, classifications in this world? Knights is a Nightmarin that went good. The Knightopians are kind of just neutral. They just kind of cut about the level. They're harmless. But, like, you can, like, breed them together and get like new sort of random variations on them. If they're all happy, they'll lay eggs and they'll start breeding, and next time you come to the level they'll be marrying them and that. You can kind of change the whole like ecology of the level by like how you
treat
these Knightopians.
McCormick, I think you're quite right in what you're saying, by the way. Like, I never noticed any of that. I was too busy just breezing about fucking doing hula hoops and that, man.
Like I've had to read a load of FAQs to like actually like understand how this whole system works, because you barely see it in the game. And you, like, as I say, if you hadn't read any of this stuff, you probably wouldn't have engaged with it at all. Because, like, I'm going through these levels trying to be as fast as possible. I'm not really stopping to smell the roses, but there's this pure simulated world going on, like, just out of reach.
Andy's flying about, trying to get the best time on bosses and that. McCormick takes a solo pass at this game, comes on this podcast and goes, guys, do you know there's eugenics in this?
I mean, that's why we need all three of our perspectives, right? You're not going to get the full story from just one.
this is the Sega Saturn at its absolute best, man. And, you know, they said it was a 2D machine, it's only going to be able to do 2D, and then they came out with this, and man, Saturn's peppered with wee classics like this that you don't find anywhere else. It's just a fucking stayed on it.
What was the second thing? You said there was two things.
Sorry, man.
Aye, so this game actually had probably the greatest demo disc of all time. Oh, at the time when demo discs were a thing. And I've not had a chance to play this, but as soon as the show's over, I'm going to stick it on, because I've got the ISO of it. But this is called Christmas Nights. And Christmas Nights was like a demo on steroids. So you just had like the first two levels of the game as a kind of demonstration, but you could unlock loads of little Christmas presents, kind of like an advent calendar. So if doing certain things in the game, you would unlock like artwork or like new bits of music or like costumes and things like that. There's also kind of an element of like, on certain days of the year, different things would happen. So like, if you play it on Christmas Day, for example, or New Year's Day, certain days where you get like kind of snow falling in the background, minor things. But also if you play it on the 1st of April, you get to play as Riala, who I've not even mentioned, that's one of the bosses, but that's like kind of the shadow to Knights as Sonic. Get to play as the villain and kind of re-skinned in that sense. The bit that kind of brought Christmas Nights to my attention, obviously growing up as a massive Sonic kid, was folks saying, here, by the way, there's a secret Sonic game actually hidden in this demo disc. And what that is it's a kind of a redo of like the bits where you're going as the two humans. Those bits aren't on like on rails, they're actually like kind of free roaming 3D. But if you unlock certain criteria in Christmas Nights, you get to play a Sonic in the world of Knights, and he can kind of run about and jump and do all the moves in a kind of fully 3D Sonic game set in these worlds, accomplishing the same thing as Knights, trying to collect all these chips and get points and everything, but doing it, you know, jumping around and spin dashing through a fully 3D world, which, I mean, the Saturn didn't have a 3D Sonic game, so that's just, like, almost as close as you're going to get to it. And this is all, like, just hidden inside a demo disc that you got free with some magazines, which is a completely lost art. Like, I mean, you kind of got that a wee bit in, like, the Amiga era, with your sensible software and stuff, but it's just so incredible that this was just something free.
When you were talking about that, yeah, to me it just sounded like these fucking Amiga Power type things. Aye. Like when you got like the, I don't know, the cannon fodder, Sensei Soccer, fucking Christmas playoff game and shit like that, but fucking on crack.
Aye. These things always feel like a bit of a labour of love. Like, I mean, didn't they have to do that? They could have just gave you the first level and that would be it done, but they decided to just pack it full of secrets and that. It's like, yeah, almost as full featured as the actual retail game, so I need to give it a wee bash.
It is, man. And it was like a sort of cheerio went into the Saturn. It was like,
yeah,
thank you and good night. Here's a fucking demo disc that's a full game. Thank you very much. Yeah. That should have been Knights 2. Fucking not that abomination.
Now, Mick, how do you feel that this stands up in its own right? Or, because for Andy, it's obviously a nostalgia trip. But, I mean, is it worth checking out for somebody with no affinity for Sega or no affinity for the Saturn or anything like that? What's the recommendation status on this one?
It's a tough one because it's so unique, kind of gameplay-wise. There's not really many things like comparative to it. But I mean, I think it's a good game, you know, maybe not for everyone. I mean, if anything we've said has kind of piqued your interest, then I'd recommend trying it. You know, good graphics, good music, it's fun, kind of breezy. Wii experience and something a bit different. So yeah, I mean, it's I'd recommend it.
And now, obviously, Andy, cat was aft, because this is one of your fucking hidden gems, or not hidden gems, but it's very unique to you. You are always going on about this game. What's your kind of conclusion here?
I think I've said everything I really need to say about it. It's obviously, I've looked at it through the tinted glasses, but if you're going to say one thing, it would be two things. You shouldn't ever meet your heroes, and you most certainly shouldn't fucking hear them talk either.
Fair play.
It's as good a final thought as any.
Well, we've got a wee bit of a kind of fucking... I think we've got a bit of a Halloween doubler coming up for you. One of them hinges on me learning the rules of the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. We're going to do a wee bit of a kind of spooky Dungeons and Dafties, but we're going to play this fucking H.P. Lovecraft-inspired version of it where cunts can go mental and everybody dies and all that. And
yes.
It'll be good fun if we can work out. But also, in case that falls through, we are also going to do just a bog-standard Spooky Neddy for you next time.
Traditional?
Traditional, we like a Halloween episode. Horror is a big part of video games. I think we are all going to just bring our aim to the table. I'm going to play Clock Tower, which is a... You might know it from PlayStation sequels or whatever, but I'm going to look at the old-school Japanese one on the Super Famicom, which is like playing through a slasher film where you're a wee lassie and you're running away from a maniac. It sounds good. Andy, what have you got for us?
Mandela Effect. It's not. I always knew this game was Zombies Ate My Neighbours, but apparently it's something called Zombies for the Mega Drive.
But again, this another instance of Europe having a crappier name, I guess.
Crappier frame rates, crappier names, fucking shite in European, man. That's why. Oh, no, I didn't have what my fucking...
Create your neighbours.
But I've got an Everdrive coming for my... I managed to get a wee Mega Drive for Oxfam in Glasgow, next to my unit.
Aye.
And this is me now. I'm getting my Everdrive dropped off soon, and I am going to be playing it on original hardware. I'm buzzing for that, man. Honestly.
Aye. And we've taken back control of our borders, as McCormick says, so now you can eat your neighbours.
That's what it was all about.
And McCormick, what are you going to be playing for our spooky episode?
So I'm bending the retro rules a little bit. I'll be playing a ROM hack of one of our favourites, the spooky Earthbound Halloween hack, which I think we've possibly mentioned before because it was created by the creator of our beloved Deltarune and Undertale. It was Mr. Toby Fox's first game, an Earthbound ROM hack, which makes things a lot more spooky and sinister. I'm looking for an excuse to play it for ages because I love the guy's other work, and Halloween seems like the best time to do it.
Well, and also it does let me and Andy actually kind of get another Earthbound episode.
Yes.
Any excuse to talk about it, man.
Earthbound episode 1.5. Fly Honey, Fuzzy Pickles, etc, etc.
Well, I've played Halloween Hack and I don't think Belchie's in it. I'll maybe take another look at it again, but we'll go through all that.
Belchie's always in it for me. I don't care if he's in or not, he's always in it. You can't have Earthbound without fucking Belchie.
Have you beat original Earthbound yet?
No, I'm still in the deep dark depths of no return. Still yet.
Literally and metaphorically.
Also, on the Spooky Games episode, I have challenged my fellow co-hosts to come on armed with their fucking top five horror movie villains. And this is what we will have at the bump at the start. So, for the record, we pumped Freddy, we pumped Jason, we pumped Michael Myers.
Pennywise.
We pumped Pinhead, we pumped Pennywise, we pumped Christine the Car, we pumped Cujo.
We let Candyman off because we felt sorry for him.
We pumped Candyman, we pumped Candyman's bees, we pumped Chucky, anytime you want to hit stop on record. I'm running out.
We're just about to get anacondas and piranhas, so you better not switch it up.
Right, see you later.